You please pray with me, O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, beloved Jesus Christ, Blessed Master, dearest Mother, saints and sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles, and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only King.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Amen. We have a new Cross and Lotus journal out, so be sure to take one on your way out. Reading from Swami Ram Dass on himself. Ram Dass was given the Ram Mantra by his guru. After his initiation, Ram Dass found that he could repeat the name constantly, without any break, and by such constant repetition, his mind was very easily became pure and still. Then it was that he began to feel that the divine he was seeking was within him. He was beginning to feel a strange peace and joy rising within his heart. This did not depend upon any external object of enjoyment. It revealed itself from within and filled him through and through. Then he knew that he was not the body, but the all-pervading eternal truth. When the body perishes, he knows he does not perish. This is the realization which grants perfect fearlessness and immortal peace. When the great awakening came to him, he found that whatever he saw around him was not stable and permanent, and therefore his search was for something eternal. This aspiration, keen and intense, seized him for realizing the immortal reality that never passes away, that never changes, and to attach himself to the things of the world meant misery, pain, and sorrow. Still, the mind was not willing to go deep down within to find the source of this life which is immortal. So God himself, in his infinite mercy, taught Ram Dass to repeat his name constantly. By this practice, the restless nature of the mind was curbed, and he was able to keep it absorbed or lost in divine consciousness. Then God gave him the knowledge and experience of the immortal, all-pervading, static, calm, and silent existence, in which he was so much lost that the world ceased to have any attraction for him. In fact, for some time, the world did not exist for him. In this state of complete forgetfulness of the world, and with only the holy name constantly on his tongue, God made him leave the place and go wandering throughout the length and breadth of India. After receiving the mantra from his guru, who was none other than his father, Ram Dass felt that it took complete possession of him. It was not he who possessed the mantra, but it was the mantra who possessed him. He was constantly repeating it, and in that repetition, from the very beginning, he felt absolute peace and joy. It was all due to God's grace, because without his grace, our mind does not turn towards him. Without our mind turning towards God, his name will not taste sweet to us or prove beneficial to us. Our mind will be wandering in many directions if we repeat the name mechanically. The mind must be attuned to the name of God, and through the name we must attain the inner consciousness or awareness of the divine. We must also feel his presence within and everywhere. The mind must be attuned to the name of God, And through the name, we must attain the inner consciousness or awareness of the divine. We must also feel his presence everywhere. This is the end that we have to attain. This mantra was working in Ram Dass's mind continuously until the mind became luminous and peaceful and all of its impurities were completely removed. Ram Dass has seen so many persons struggling on the path of God realization or God vision, but they have not been able to root out the desires of their lower nature. From Ram Dass's experience, he can boldly say that by repetition of the mantra given to you by a guru, you can make your mind absolutely pure like a crystal. Purity of mind is essential for God vision. From Ram Dass's experience, he can boldly say that by the repetition of the mantra given to you by a guru, you can make your mind absolutely pure like a crystal. Purity of mind is essential for God vision. You must be absolutely honest, straightforward, and free from lust, greed, and wrath. Then only can God be yours. You can realize him, experience him, live, move, and have your being in him at all times. In hearing the words from someone who has realized the truth, such as Papa, or any other great spiritual master that has realized that truth, it has a purifying effect upon the mind. And it lifts us up. It shows us what is possible within our very selves. Papa would never want God realization only for himself, but that he saw it as ultimately attainable by one and all, but that there is an exacting path upon which we must place ourselves. He felt that being a bhakta, the lover of God, is the easiest and best way in order to approach God. Why? Because when you start to repeat the name of God, and you feel that peace, that bliss, even from the very beginning, you're repeating the name, you're thinking of God's virtues, you're thinking of him in all of his glory. O Lord, you are all-powerful, you are transcendent, you are truth, you are purity, you are all and all and all, and you think like this while you're chanting the name. And in this way, you put yourself into attunement with the pure word of God. Now the name of God and God are one, but the inner name is the feeling, that vibration. And that is what the bhakta latches onto. It's that feeling of purity. It's that feeling of bliss. And it begins to lift you up. It begins to purify you. And it's a positive, wonderful kind of feeling that you get. And you want more of it. And so you chant God's name more, you repeat his virtues more, you put yourself into attunement with all of the truths that God has given to you. And in this way, your mind is completely purified. And once your mind is purified, only God remains. If you think about having some water that has been sullied and all muddy, and you put it through a filtering process, and what comes out is only pure, clean water. And that your spiritual practice is that filter. Only God goes through that filter of God remembrance and comes out on the other side. Everything else is left behind. And so it is with this knowledge and this experience that all great masters are able to say, your true nature, that water, pure water, so to speak, no matter how sullied it may be in the current conditions, can be purified through perfect God remembrance. And in that way, you too, everyone, can experience that uplifting, transforming presence of God. This is a tremendous message. It is a tremendous truth. And really, there is nothing else other than that than getting to work and starting to put ourselves into harmony with everything that that God has given to us. Mataji used to scold at times people at the ashram. Why do you come here year after year and make no spiritual progress? And people would hang their heads down and look down. And you have to learn, you have not even learned the ABCs of spiritual practice. Then how do you come here and expect to have that transformation if you're not willing to practice? And sometimes we need a scolding. Sometimes we need a wake-up call because we get so complacent. We don't necessarily like our circumstances, but we get complacent with it. There is something called the Stockholm Effect, and it was by these psychologist types who got together and took these college students, and they put them into a prison of war kind of camp where they were just completely living in this prison of war camp. And after a while, what they noticed was if somebody stepped out of line with what the guards wanted, the other inmates started to blame the person who stepped out of line. Well, if you didn't step out of line, that guard would not have been angry. We would not have gotten punished in this way. And so they called it the Stockholm Effect because the inmates actually started to identify with the guards and the very people who are keeping them in prison. And you might say that in this world of Maya, this world of delusion, that many people suffer from Stockholm Effect. They actually begin to identify with Maya. They identify with delusion. And as a result of that, they keep the play going. They keep the play going. So Maya is the great veil, the cosmic veil that is dropped down and hidden from our sight, the divine light and the divine vision that Papa so ardently speaks about. So we must break that spell that Maya has put upon us. So Maya is attachment to those things that benefit us. If it's family, if it's ones who can give us something that we're looking for, then we're all for it. And anybody outside of that circle is toast, you might say. They don't mean anything. In fact, they might even be seen as the enemy. But Daya is compassion. And Daya is universal compassion for everyone and everything. It breaks that little circle that the mind draws around you and says, oh, your compassion only goes out to so-and-so. It may be just people in your family. It may be just you. It may be a very tight circle. It may be just people that you identify as your community or your church or your religion. And everybody else is outside of that. It may be somebody part of your culture. But if it's part of another culture, they're strange, they're foreign, they do things differently, and you don't feel any connection with them. So to have this Daya, to have this universal compassion that goes out and breaks that little circle that we put ourselves in. Swami Satchidananda used to use as a measurement, he said every day, think about, has my circle of love expanded today? And if it has not, then are you really doing your spiritual growth? And it's so easy to get into this complacency, this forgetfulness, where we can even be doing all the outward things for doing spiritual practice, but really, inside, we're not doing it because we're really not getting the results. This last weekend, we had Loon Lake Retreat, and for those who didn't come, the entitlement was One Virtue Leads to Another. And I thought I'd read to you because it's such a tremendous thing. It was from a talk that Mother gave, June 18th, 1980. And she read from Star Daly's story. Now, Star Daly was a wonderful individual. He started out not so wonderful. He did some crime. He killed someone. And I don't know what the circumstances were, but he was sentenced to life in prison. And then he met somebody within the prison who helped to change his life. And Mother said that he was a disciple of Master's. So, but I don't know of any of the details of what that looked like or how that happened. But he wrote about his experiences. And while he was in prison, and he was an inspiration for our monthly classes where we take a particular topic and we go deeper with it. We took this last month for around devil and the temptation and going deeper with that. And he was, it's very endearing that sometimes he said that he would read something because he had opened the Bible at random and that's what he would take for his month-long study. And so sometimes he would open up the Bible and he'd read something and he'd think, well, that's too far beyond me. I'm not ready to be able to practice that. And he'd open up the Bible again and find another passage that he thought he was more able to do. But then he would keep track all through the month around his experiences. And he worked in the infirmary there at the prison. And he would seek to enact this principle that he had read about. So he was very sincere. And he was always about deepening his spiritual progress. But he wrote this story. And I want to read to you from this talk that Mother gave in which she read this story, because I think it's a tremendous thing. And this is Mother. I want to speak to you tonight about the law of being. Everything that we are doing, everything that we practice, everything that we read about, everything that I teach you is but for one purpose, and that is to teach you how to become masters of yourself, to become masters of your own destiny. Many, many years ago, a great man by the name of Star Daly, who was imprisoned for murdering someone, had a great change of heart. He met a man in that prison who became his master, and this man who had taken another life finally himself became a great master and changed totally. He was a disciple of my guru, and he wrote many beautiful things. His name, Star Daly, was a name which he took while he was in prison. It was not his real name. He wrote this article, How to Become a Master. I've told it once or twice before, but I thought I would like to read it to you so that you would be able to really absorb every word of it, so that it will help you on your journey. Once upon a time, there was born in America a child of destiny. He was born with three great but primary desires, which culminated in a fourth desire greater than all the other three combined. At 4 years of age, this child was called a prodigy, manifesting at his tender period definite indications pointing to the fulfillment of his first desire. It was freely predicted that he would become a master artist. At 21, he had made the most exaggerated of these predictions come true. He was the master of the four leading arts, painting, music, literature, and drama. The world of art lay at his feet, and art lovers the world over poured their adulations upon him. But strangely enough, this mass flattery did not spoil him. A peculiar quality in his character compelled him to embrace criticism and shrink from praise. At 22, the second desire entered his life to become the predominant factor governing all of his acts. He became a material scientist. Here, too, he soon rose to great honors, and all that could be given to him in the way of homage, degrees, and chairs were attached to his name. But again, that peculiar quality in his character left him unspoiled in the presence of man's flattery, flattering recognition, and high distinction. At 36, the third of his three great desires took possession of him, and he entered the field of philosophy. At 45, he had written a sizable library of philosophical works, and every student the world over was reading and applying his numerous systems of thought. His conclusions had become academic dogmas, and in all the orthodox halls of Western world learning, he was being lavishly referred to as the greatest brain of all times. He was the best known man in the world. And yet, that peculiar quality in his character forced him to recognize the fact that he was the loneliest man in the world, the hungriest man of all, and the most dissatisfied. Once an intimate friend sought him out to offer a personal bit of praise on the latest of his long string of brilliant essays. He turned a pair of weary, defeated eyes to his friend and said, "I aim like a child digging holes in a pile of sand. Once dug, the novelty of the task is gone. The hole remains for a little while, but even while it remains, it is empty." And then, at 46, came the crowning desire of them all, the desire to become a master, took control of him. He left the shores of the Western world and journeyed to India in search of one who could teach him how to become a master of life and destiny, who could show him how to fill his hole of empty knowledge with the golden grains of eternal and never-shifting wisdom. For 3 years, he traveled about from temple to temple, from university to university, from library to library. He researched through ancient records and manuscripts. He attached himself to one instructor after another. His eager, sponge-like brain soaked up everything he came in contact with. But the more he accumulated, the more complex the world became, and the more futile his efforts appeared. Finally, thoroughly frustrated and despairing of ever achieving this last of his great desires, he became disillusioned. His nerves broke under the strain, and he sank into a condition of dull hopelessness. This served only to aggravate his torment. In an effort to escape from its taunting misery, he resorted to vice. One vicious, degrading habit after another he acquired until he was completely in the clutches of all that was foul and unspeakable in human conduct and behavior. He had gone so low in this scale that the most depraved sickened at his approach. At this juncture he was, he decided, at the end of his resources and endurance. There is nothing left but misery and death, not life, but could but put an end to that now. He went to the river as the most likely to carry out his final gesture of human defeat. As he approached the river, he observed a group of persons, most of them young, who appeared to be of the student class. They were clustered around an old man who sat cross-legged and who appeared to be talking. As he watched, he noticed that every once in a while, one or two of the youths would separate from the circle and walk away, shaking their heads in a wise, patronizing manner, as if to say, "Poor fellow, he has not much to contribute in the way of learning." Finally, one of the departing youths came by where he stood watching, and he asked of the passerby, "What is that old man doing there?" The youth laughed knowingly. "I doubt if he knows himself," he replied. "We've heard that he was a wise man, but he has no discourse. He prattles things that should be taught to babies." With this, the youth went blithely and laughingly on his way. By and by, there was no student left, and the old man sat alone on the ground. Something stirred in the breast of the man contemplating suicide. He approached the seer and spoke. The seer nodded, and the old man told him his story. "I came all the way to India," he finished, "in search of one who could teach me how to be a master. Now it is too late. In me, all of the vices have triumphed, and all of the virtues have been defeated." "It is never too late," said the seer calmly, "for wisdom and time never abide in the same place." "Can you teach me how to overcome my vices?" the man asked eagerly. "Vices are but inverted virtues, my child, like a cup turned upside down. I can teach you how to set the cup in order and how to fill it with living water." Flame leapt into the bewildered man's eyes of the seeker. His dissipated face became animated under the rising heart pressure of renewed hope. "Could you teach me how to become a master?" he asked breathlessly. To master one thing is to master all things, said the seer dreamily, providing the one thing is the right thing. Tell me, pleaded the seeker, what that one thing is. I shall become a master. The seer took up a stick and began writing in the sand. When he paused, he had written a column of 12 words. He then asked the seeker to pronounce each one of them aloud, and the seeker obeyed, beginning at the top of the list. Love, truthfulness, honesty, patience, kindness, generosity, humility, courtesy, unselfishness, good temper, guilelessness, and sincerity. Now, resumed the master, of those 12 words, pick out the one that most appeals to you and tell me what your choice is. For a long time, the seeker studied the column thoughtfully. Of all the words there, he said at last, the word kindness most appeals to me, because for almost a year now, you are the only one who has offered kindness to me instead of insult. Very well, said the seer. I shall send you to a merchant friend of mine who will provide you with food. With this, you will seek an out-of-the-way place, and there you will practice the art of being kind to nature and all the creatures of nature with which you come in contact. 12 times 12 days, and you will practice, and then you will return to me for further instruction. But can this lead the way to mastership? It seems quite simple. The greatest accomplishments result from simple methods, advised the seer. But simple methods are not always easy to follow. You must be strong and determined. The seeker went away, and at the end of his allotted period, he returned with tales of enthusiasm to his teacher. He had made friends with birds and animals and had performed wonderful things with vegetation. The seer was pleased but showed no sense of surprise. Nor did he ask the seeker how he had lived without his acquired habits during this period of isolation. Instead, he instructed the seeker in the next step of his practice in kindness. It would be a more difficult step than the one preceding. Now he must remain in the world of human beings and practice kindness on them. He must try to be kind to those even who were unkind to him. He would probably fail time and time again, and his vices would no doubt strive even harder against him. He was not to fight his vices, nor was he to stop practicing kindness because he failed many times. And once again, the seeker's period of probation and practice was set at 12 times 12 days, at the end of which period he would again return for instruction. When his time was up, he once more returned to the teacher. Now he had even greater tales of conquest to offer. His kind being had attracted much attention, and he had been relieved of his rags and vermin and had come into a position of trust where he had steadily regained much of his self-respect. He was on his way back to the high place in life he had once occupied. But it was not yet what he wanted, and besides, he still possessed many of the acquired habits his journey down had fastened upon him. Again, the seer was pleased, but not surprised. You have done well indeed, he said. But tell me, asked the seeker, how may I conquer my vices? How may I become a master by the practice of kindness? Now you can feel kindly toward nature and all of creatures of nature. The seer, you can now feel kindly towards nature and all the creatures of nature? The seer asked. I can, affirmed the seeker. And you hold every human being in kindly regard? Yes, I mastered the art of being kind to my fellow man. Very well, then, said the seer. You are ready to take the last and most difficult step. You are ready to take the last and most difficult step. Can you imagine what that is? If you can practice kindness on yourself, you will dissolve all of your vices, and then you will be a master. Wisdom will wait on your table, and your cup will be filled with living water. But it seems too easy to be true, the seeker said. Is it not easier to be kind to oneself than to others? It would seem so, replied the seer. But to be kind to yourself, you must be master of your thoughts, your emotions, your words, and your actions. Because every unkind thought, emotion, word, or action you express is detrimental to yourself. To be always kind to yourself, you must do nothing to injure yourself. You must do nothing to injure yourself. I'm afraid I don't quite follow you, the seeker said thoughtfully. To be kind to yourself, the seer explained, you would have to have all 12 virtues I wrote down perfected in your life. By perfecting one, you perfect them all, you see. No one of them can be perfectly present if any or all of the others happen to be absent. Can you see that? I believe I can, the seeker admitted. If you are kind to yourself, for instance, the seer went on, you will be absolutely honest with yourself, because to be dishonest is harmful, and you cannot be kind to yourself and harmful at the same time. If you are honest with yourself, you will always be sincere. You will express no thought that is untruthful or destructive. You will be courteous, not for the effect, but because you mean it and feel it. And if you are kind to yourself, you will express patience, love, generosity, unselfishness, good temper, guilelessness, humility. If you master the art of self-kindness, you will be a great master. Now, go back to your duties, and after 12 times 12 days, I shall come to you to be instructed in those things which you have that I have not, symbolic art and material science and philosophy. Life is based on giving and receiving. And when we are wise, we know that wisdom goes on, and no man gets all. He is the wise man who can drink simplicity from the cup in a teacher's hand. He is wiser still who, as the teacher, can drink from the cup held in the hand of his pupil. And so it came to pass that after 12 times 12 days, a great master of India came, meek, humble, and simple, to sit at the feet of one whom he had trained to be his master and teacher. And after 12 times 12 days, the Eastern master said to the master from the West, "Now we are even. I have given you of my wisdom, and you have given me of yours." He held out his hand, which the master from the West took, and thus did East and West unite in a hand clasp of brotherhood. That lovely story. And so very true that you have to have all the virtues intact if you are really to practice any one of them. Many times we don't learn the ABCs of a spiritual life. To be truthful, for instance, is a great practice to do, to put that into being. Always be truthful. Master and Papa both told the same story about a fellow who was a dacoit. He was a criminal. And he was being chased by the posse, and he came upon a saint who was sitting underneath the tree. And he ran up that tree, and he asked the saint, "Don't tell them where I'm at. If they find me, they will kill me." And Papa told the story, and he said that he could not tell a lie, and that when the people approached, he pointed upwards, the saint pointed upwards, and told them where he was. Master used the same story for a different effect and said, "Sometimes, in order to effect a good, you have to do something that's not quite right." And he would not tell. The saint did not tell where he was at. He misled them. It's interesting that neither one, Papa nor Master, gave the third option, which is for the saint not to say anything at all, no matter what they did to him. In order for us to be truthful at all times, of course we have to be truthful to ourselves. We can't lie to ourselves. We can't tell untruths to ourselves. We learn to speak every word coming from truth. And as we rise up in spiritual consciousness, if even by mistake we speak an untruth, it causes us some pain. And again, it's not a moral kind of a thing where you judge yourself to be wrong. It actually causes you pain. If you go against any one of those great spiritual principles, it begins to cause you pain and difficulty, and you feel it very keenly. Sri Yukteswarji said to Master, after he had left the body, that he was serving in an astral heaven above the normal astral worlds in a planet called Hiranyaloka. And there he was helping very highly advanced astral beings prepare themselves to enter into the even more vast, more beautiful causal realm. And that the beings there who were practicing, even if they had slight misperception of truth, would cause them great pain. This pain is the shepherd's hook that takes a wayward sheep or a thought and shows you that it has gone off the reservation, so to speak, and uses a prod to bring you back. So it's a great teacher. And pain can operate like this. It can help to awaken us when we take it in the right way. Everything that we experience in this life can be a prompter to go further to God, or it can bring the ego out in a greater measure that takes us further away from God. How do we know that we're going further towards God? And it is that we feel a greater sense of purity, a greater sense of peace, a greater sense of that presence of God within us. It is not always that life goes easier on the outside. This is a misperception, because what it doesn't take into account is that we have a long list of karma, of cause and effect, and it may not have anything to do with what we're doing in the present, but has something to do with what we did long ago in the past. We may be doing everything right in the present, and yet something untoward comes to us. I have seen people, there is a certain group of thought, that you create all of your experiences. If you change your thought, you change your world. And there is a certain truth to this, but it's not an absolute truth, because there are these things that are outside our immediate control. And I've seen people, there's a person who was in an accident, an automobile accident, and someone asked them, it was like a bludgeoning instrument, the way that they ask it, what were you thinking to make that happen? And it was punishing and meant to be so. Was not loving. And so you can get into that kind of thinking without the fuller understanding of the really complex world that we live in. That not everything is as it seems. It's all right, and it's good to question yourself, was I being absent-minded? Was I thinking something negative? Was there a fear that was driving me and helped to create this kind of situation? Those are excellent questions to ask. But it can be that there are times that you are doing everything correctly and still something happened. Some illness comes, some accident, some financial downturn. And the main point is keeping your mind on God. Because whatever the cause and effect, the answer, the solution, resolves in God remembrance. Whatever you have done in this life, whatever you have done in previous lives, is all solvable. It is all changeable to bring it into conformance with the one truth and the one light and the one life. But we must practice. We must get involved in these ABCs. Just living a good life is not something to be looked down upon. It's not easy to always tell the truth. I know I came into this lifetime, I think, maybe with a tendency not to tell the truth, at least as a child. And I think this is true of many of us as children, that if we were caught doing something we shouldn't, you could just tell a lie instead of owning up to it, thinking that perhaps you could avoid the punishment that would come. But with every lie comes a consequence. I remember when I went to work for a certain organization that required degrees in order to be able to hold certain positions. And there was a man there that it was discovered that he had forged his degree. And he was summarily fired and ruined any chances he had for getting a good job in that area thereafter. And it's a big price to pay, but what he did was wrong. When we do something that is wrong, we quickly own up to it. And we go about trying to change it. I think the thing that many of us get frustrated with is when somebody just goes from one lie to another. They're not honest with themselves, perhaps. They're certainly not honest with the world. I remember I worked for an individual who just was in the habit of lying. He owned the company. And the more that I got to know him, the more that I saw, he would lie even when it wasn't necessary. And it was incredible to watch. There's no reason, there was no real benefit from him doing it, and still he would do it. And so finally, he and I were on a trip together, and we had kind of a down and out, you might say. And I said, I'm sick of this. I'm not going to be a part of this. And he became very angry with me and said, you don't understand. In order to make it in business, you have to lie. I said, I don't accept that. And he got on an airplane and flew home, and I drove the rest of the way. And that was the end of that. So there are times when you are confronted, it's put right out in front of you. And there are times when we may be caught in a lie ourselves, that we may not tell the truth. And it causes a lot of pain. And the thing is, sometimes it can be a small lie. But then it throws into question every single thing you say. How can you be trusted? How can you be trusted? And so it can seem unfair, but there can be huge consequences from saying one thing that is untrue. Now, as Star Daily wrote here, everything is connected. Every virtue is connected to another, and so there are no small virtues. There are no small missteps, because if you take a misstep in one area, it affects all the others. If you tell a lie, for instance, or you steal, or you cheat, or anything else, it puts a veil between you and God. And then you go to your meditation blanket and you wonder, why am I not making any progress? Why am I not feeling God? And it may come to your mind, oh, look at how I treated so-and-so, or in this particular situation. And if I did it there, that's going to absolutely put a veil between me and God. And every time I do that, it makes that veil, it makes that wall thicker and thicker. And pretty soon, I'm disowned. I've disowned myself from God. I've disowned myself from the people around me, because it's isolative when that happens. Jesus said a wonderful thing. He said, thank you, Father, for hiding these great truths from the wise and from the learned. Isn't that interesting? Thank you for hiding this from the wise and the learned and revealing it to the childlike. Why? Because the childlike are simple. They're not calculating. They don't think what the angle is. They don't think of what the benefit is. They just simply are. And they're childlike in their simplicity. That's the kind of simplicity that we have to go to God with. We have to admit before Him everything that we've done, not because God needs to see us humbled, but because we need to humble ourselves before that wall that we ourselves have built can come down. And if we have done many things wrong against truth and against God and against the light, the things that we know that we should, and then suddenly we want connection with God and we think the wall should just disappear. But we have to take that wall apart. Now, God will help us to do it when we're sincere in it. But still, we must do it. And we must take it down a brick at a time. We must take all of it down. Every last piece of it, because any little piece is still a veil between ourselves and the infinite. But when we do, we come into that state of childlike simplicity and purity. We get what Papa talks about. It's the reason why when we read Papa's words, it explodes with truth and purity and light. Because he's saying it from that state of consciousness. There's nothing to hide. There's no other agenda. Nothing else going on. Papa has what he set out to get. Universal love and vision and peace and enlightenment. The Sat Chit Ananda. Pure consciousness, pure existence, pure bliss is all his. Like a mighty kingdom that he stepped into. And all of its assets, all of its virtues became his. And as it is with everyone who realizes their oneness with God. So let us examine our lives every day. Does our circle of love expand today? Is there somebody that we're holding things against? And you may say, well, it's not a big deal, but it happened a long time ago. And, you know, you just realize you have an emotional charge about it. Give it to God. Give it to his feet. If something has unfair or you feel like it's unfair has happened to you and you hold anger or hatred or resentment, that is a veil between you and God. Now, it's probably not hurting the other person at all. But you're doing it in punishment to that person for what they did to you. And yet, it doesn't hurt them, but it hurts you. Isn't that an irony? And so to let that go, to dissolve everything that is not of God, become childlike in that simplicity. Offer your life, your consciousness. God knows everything that you've done. Even those things that you hope nobody ever discovers about you. God knows it already. What are you hiding it from exactly? It's just our pride that keeps us from openly admitting it to God, giving it to his feet, asking to be purified of this, surrendering it to him, giving it all over to him. And then we can be free. Because I came into this world, it seems, with a strong quota of shame and kind of feeling like I needed to apologize just for my existence at times. And so I thought about, all right, if everything that I've done is suddenly broadcasted on the headlines of the newspaper, could I face that with equanimity? It may not be things that I would like to advertise, but suddenly there it is. And could I see it there with perfect equanimity? Could I be all right with it? Is yes, that is something that I did. I'm sorry that I did that. I wish that I had not. I want to learn from having done that, but there it is. And I'm at peace with God. I'm at peace with myself. I've sought out his forgiveness. And can I be completely neutral towards it, no matter who knows, no matter who says it, where it's broadcast to? And I think this is a wonderful practice to go through in your mind. And if there is something that you continue to want to hold back from, then it may very well be part of that veil that is between you and God. And to let it go. You don't have to broadcast it to the world. Mother went through a service one time where she said she talked about every God-blessed thing that she wanted no one else to hear about at all. But God spoke it out through her. And she told all of her sins, so to speak. And that's one way. That's one way. I don't think it's everybody's way. But that you could speak it out if God so prompted you and do it without fear. That everybody has made mistakes on the way up. Everyone has made mistakes. Jesus, Babaji, everyone made mistakes. But to let it go. Let it become part of your past. Let it be something that you learn from. And move forward. And let it no longer be a barrier between you and God. And you realize that all virtues are interconnected. And there's no such thing as a little transgression. They're all connected, and if you go against one, you go against truth as a totality. So let us begin tearing down that wall and bringing ourselves into complete union with God, where we can go before Him as a child. And whatever comes to our mind, we know perfectly well that He is conscious of it. And when we have surrendered it to it, He holds nothing against us. It is we ourselves who want to hide in the shadows, but to step into the light boldly, with nothing to hide and nothing to be ashamed of. His child. And allowing Him to be our beloved. Will you please pray with me?
O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
Of thy glorious presence.
In every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
And surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
Surging through every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with Thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with Thee.
Of my communion with Thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Out of the light within you.